Hello, everyone, and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
And yeah, we're sitting tight here in Germany, I guess. Germany, the numbers are climbing. The COVID-19 infections, Omicron infections, basically, at this point, are still on the rise here.
Yeah, on the right, they have broken all the records. They're breaking the record for daily cases every single day. And nobody seems to care, politicians included. No new measures are even being debated. They're just essentially letting Omicron rip through society.
Without saying it.
Without saying it, yeah.
Without saying that that's the plan, that's the idea here. Things,
practically speaking, that's what's happening. Yeah.
Have not closed. Yeah, that's what's, again, my prediction was wrong. Back right before Christmas, when there were rumors of a national level meeting of all the German states that was going to determine kind of some of the anti-COVID measures, yeah. I was certain that we were going back to lockdowns. That hasn't happened. A lot of what Germans call 2G plus, so you have to be vaccinated, boosted,
or have just recovered,
or have just recovered, and have a negative antigen test or rapid test to get in places. But otherwise, life is pretty normal here in Germany, as strange as that sounds. And yes, even, I mean, Deutsche Welle, we've got, what is it, our colleagues in Berlin, more than 40 of them are currently infected, mm-hmm. Probably with Omicron here in Bonn, which is where we do radio and online. I think the number is about 20, closer to 20 at the moment.
So what it's actually like is probably a lot higher. I mean, the health minister has said a number of times that the actual number of people who are infected is probably 2, maybe even 3 times higher than people who have been officially diagnosed. But that's where it's at. And today, the head of the World Health Organization, the European chapter, Hans Kluge, Europe director for the WHO, said 3 in 5 people are going to get Omicron in the next 4 weeks.
Oh, so they've upped that.
60% now.
The reason I'm laughing is for weeks now, we've been repeating what the WHO has said, and it was always 1 in 2 Europeans, yeah. So 50%. So now
it's 3 in 5.
Now critically, it's 60% instead of 50. That, okay, we're laughing about it, but that may actually be relevant ultimately for hospitalizations and the number of ICU beds.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'll get to that in a second. What he also said after saying that was that the end of the pandemic is coming. He told the AFP that in 2022, where things look like it's going to close up shop when it comes to COVID-19. He didn't say that exactly, but here's what he did say, that the COVID-19 pandemic will become predictable. Mm-hmm. And that's a very funny word to use, because that's kind of a synonym for endemic, when something is no longer epidemic, that you can manage it, you can deal with it because you can predict it. That's the word he chose there. He didn't say that it's going to become endemic, mm-hmm. but effectively he did. Again, he said 3 in 5 Europeans will get it. And then after that, it's just going to kind of go away, because there won't be any susceptible hosts left. What he is forgetting, though, is what if there's a new variant?
That's what I was going to say. That's a bold...
This is the head of the WHO in Europe.
Bold and very surprising thing to say from the head of a public health body. Typically, they tend to stress what they don't know. And how much we don't know, all of us, about what's going to happen next. And then also to err on the side of caution and to suggest that people should, you know, probably still be careful. But he's kind of taken a different tact. I mean, I would love for him to be right. My own prediction or hope is that by April, that curve will be on the downswing in a major way, and that hopefully we won't have a new variant to talk about, another Greek letter.
Yeah, but what you said before about hospitalizations, I think it should be said that Omicron, even though it clearly is milder than Delta, if you look at the numbers, it's going to be a huge problem for healthcare systems and hospitals all over the world, because even if, based on new data, fresh data out of Southern California, it looks like that the hospitalization rate for Omicron is less than half compared to Delta, mm-hmm. right? So let's say they had numbers here that approximately for Delta at the peak, 0.7% of cases needed to be hospitalized. Mm-hmm. Let's say that's 0.3% for Omicron.
Sure.
Given that there are 5 times more cases of Omicron, there's going to be more people hospitalized.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now, this needs to be said, even though the way in which they have to be hospitalized is definitely different. That was also present in this Southern California data, an average of 3 days less time spent in the hospital, less oxygenation, and People waving at me here outside the Deutsche Welle studios.
You're a popular guy, Gabe.
What was I saying there?
Less oxygenation. Less
oxygenation and less ventilation. So it's a different kind of hospitalizations, but it still means that more people are going to be in hospitals, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Now that's the odd part of this, of the Omicron numbers, I guess, it is just numbers. The infection is less severe, intrinsically less severe. That is known. That can be said. Mm-hmm. It's just so many people are being infected that the hospital beds are being filled up.
Yeah.
Regardless.
All right.
Yeah.
That's it.
So we are still on the upswing here in Germany. We'll have to see when we can officially declare, as we said last week, I believe, that Omicron is peaking in certain places around the world. Not the case yet here in Germany. I look forward to that being the case, when we can start riding the toboggan down the back slope of this wave.
What do you got for me? Also COVID? Are we moving on?
I've got two things for you. And the first one is COVID related, and it's related to fertility or the ability to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
As related to, like, after you've had either a COVID-19 infection or a COVID-19 vaccination. And it's that vaccination that I'm going to talk about first and kind of focus on.
Okay.
And I'm going to work my way to the most recent study. I think it needs a little context. And the context, at least for me, starts with a study that came out just a couple weeks ago. This was data on the fact that women who have had a COVID-19 vaccine, typically, there were tons of anecdotal reports about menstrual cycles being delayed. Tons of anecdotes.
There has been a study on that since, right?
Yes, there
was.
Was
it a day? A day, approximately 1 day delayed, right?
Correct. After the first dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, there was a 0.71-day cycle increase, so a delay by 0.7 days. And after the second dose, it was 0.9 days, so a little bit less than a day in both cases. And by the way,
is that a big deal?
It's how do I say, par for the course. This is not a new thing that's limited to the COVID-19 vaccine. This has happened before with typhoid, hepatitis vaccines, the human papillomavirus vaccines. This happens sometimes. We're not going to get into the immunology the immunology of why that's the case for this broadcast or this episode. The point is just that was happening, and it took a long time for us to have data showing exactly how long. All these women out there basically saying, hey, have you had this? I've been experiencing this. And that is problematic that it took so long for a report to come out on this. If any of you out there want to read more on kind of why that's problematic, one of our colleagues, Sonia Dean, on DW.com, you can find it. It's called After COVID-19 Vaccine Menstruation Findings, A Sigh of Relief and Indignation. And she's basically there. One of her arguments is saying, why wasn't this tracked from the beginning? Why did it take this long? It's not one of those things that they tracked as part of, you know, the COVID-19 vaccination campaign. It came out because the data that report was based on was from a Swiss app where women and men who are with their partners manually enter their menstrual cycle information. And so they could take a look at those apps and kind of figure out what had changed.
And the indignation in Sonia's title, it's a strong, very strong word, indignation. Was because it wasn't looked at in the trials?
Or? Well, effectively, she has a lot more to say, and I don't want to do her injustice, but effectively, if you're going to track things like headaches and sore arms and other, you know, known predictable side effects, why not also track that so that we have very good information right from the beginning?
Why not is the question.
That's the good question. Let's do this in the future, folks. So here's the thing. The problem with not tracking that, the problem with having all of these anecdotes floating around there is I have heard, for example, from our babysitter, who's a young woman, she's 18 years old. She was scared that, you know, you hear those kinds of things and it seems possible to a young person, to anyone, that maybe that's going to affect my ability to have, you know, a pregnancy, to get pregnant in the future. Maybe I will become infertile. Right? Now, there is no evidence anywhere to suggest that that is the case. I'm going to drop a couple things on you here. One was, the very first was from the AstraZeneca trials, where they showed that if you remember those very first trials, they're injecting some people with AstraZeneca and some people with a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who got AstraZeneca, there were 50 pregnancies there. Yeah. And in the placebo group, 43. Already an indication that, I mean, you could basically call it a 50-50 split.
Okay.
This isn't affecting anything. They also have lots of data from in vitro fertilization attempts, and there was no association whatsoever between a COVID-19 vaccination and, you know, the rate of success when that embryo is implanted, or, you know, the outcome of that pregnancy.
This is only for the women then? It's not on both sides, for men and women?
It is also for men. So for men, here there were three separate studies. Men who had a COVID-19 vaccine. You know, is that going to affect my fertility as a man? Going to do no, absolutely not. There was no appreciable, I'm quoting here, no appreciable difference in semen volume, sperm concentration, or motility measures, how they move, before and after COVID-19 vaccination. None. Here's the thing. You can throw all of that information out the window here's the thing. If you've had COVID-19, that's very different. So if you've had a COVID-19 infection, for men, that tends to lead to poor sperm quality, decreased concentration, lower motility, and something called increased DNA fragmentation. And the suspicion there...
Is this a new study?
No, I'm going through it. The newest part is right at the end.
Okay.
I'll get, and it basically confirms the others. But what's happening with men with a COVID-19 infection, the suspicion, that's what the authors wrote in the study, is that could be a result of fever or inflammation. So you've got a nasty fever. We all know that high temperatures are not good for men and sperm quality. That's the issue there.
Did they take the severity of the infection into account, or was this just anyone with a COVID-19 infection?
I believe anyone with a COVID-19 infection.
And vaccinated or not, probably also no differentiation there.
I would have to look into the data again. My guess, it would have to be the case that if you've had an extremely severe COVID-19 infection...
More shock to the immune system would mean less well-performing sperm?
Probably. I mean, fever. Fever is directly connected to lower sperm quality. And with women, with regard to a COVID-19 infection, they tend to also experience menstrual cycle changes. Decreased menstrual volume and prolonged menstrual cycles, so they get kind of thrown out of whack as well. Mm-hmm. So again, it is fair to say that a COVID-19 vaccine might change a menstrual cycle, but so too with a COVID-19 infection. And so
the difference isn't even close between the two.
Now that I'm looking at it more closely, I'm not sure exactly how much worse that would be for a woman with a severe COVID-19 infection. I've actually reached out to the authors of that study on menstrual cycles and am waiting to hear back or to find a time that we can talk to them. Mm-hmm. But this finally leads us to our last piece of the evidence. This is the new information, and maybe kind of interest to our listeners out there. There is something, if you're in the U.S. or Canada, called PRESTO, PRESTO. This is the Pregnancy Study Online. And anyone who wants to volunteer their information, anyone between, I think the age limits are 21 to 45, and they're just tracking who's trying to get pregnant and whether or not it's working out for them. And then, of course...
Trying to track any irregularities or...
Well, and asking a lot of other, I think, lifestyle questions to figure out what's impacting young people or anyone's attempt to get pregnant. So there, what they did, they had more than 2,000 people by the end of the study, meaning it worked with roughly 2,000 people. And basically almost all of last year, 2021, all the way up through September, they were trying to figure out, okay, if we look at the data this way, people are trying to get pregnant, and some of them are vaccinating in the midst of all this. Is that going to change anything? And what they showed is that, what I found kind of odd, women who got vaccinated during this time had an even slightly higher chance of getting pregnant. I mean, it's probably not statistically significant. So if the baseline is 1, this was 1.08, so 8% higher, not much. Men, if they got vaccinated, it dropped off just a tick, but again, not statistically significant.
So yeah, just like the 43 compared to 50 in the AstraZeneca study, negligible.
It's a wash. However, looking at those same people who were trying to get pregnant, they also had people in those 2,000, in the group of 2,000, who got a COVID-19 infection during that time. Again, I'm not sure the severity. There, things changed a lot. So for the 30 days after infection, if, you know, there was like 100% probability of a certain amount of people getting pregnant during that time, that drops to 20%. If you've had a COVID-19 infection in the last 30 days. Now, part of this to me is totally obvious, right? If you've had a COVID-19 infection,
Having less sex?
Probably. And that's not the time. You're wheezing, you're coughing, you're tired, you're out of breath going up the stairs. I don't think that's the time where you're like, let's have that baby now, this cycle, this
no
week.
Marvin Gaye being played.
No 70s music in the background. No, and so to me, that wasn't much of a surprise. Up to 60 days later, the reduction was no longer 80%. The reduction was 18%. Hmm. And then, this is what I found interesting and reassuring, after that, it leveled off and things went back to normal. So statistically speaking,
even if you've had COVID, you can still have a kid.
60 days later or more, there's no difference. Mm-hmm. With women, there was a much lower impact. This tended to be, if I'm not sure if I made that clear, the men who had the drop off.
You did say that, yeah.
After the COVID-19 infection.
Yeah,
and so that is where we stand in terms of whether or not having a COVID-19 infection impacts your ability to have a child in the future or in the very near future versus a COVID-19 vaccine. Just to summarize again, a COVID-19 vaccine has no effect. There's lots of data, whether it's from IVF laboratories or from urological clinics or now from these mass surveys. COVID-19 vaccines don't change the equation at all.
If you had the infection, an infection in the wake, in the immediate wake of the infection, and then that kind of tapers off, and then you're back to normal.
That's it. Yeah, that's what all the data shows, and that's what you can please repeat to anyone you know who has been, I don't know, made to feel really insecure about having children in the future in this strange pandemic world. And it seems to me like way too much emphasis was given on the vaccines in terms of, oh my gosh, maybe if I get vaccinated, I won't be able to have a child. That's not true at all. If you're going to talk about a risk, the risk is...
Well, it's because people were given the question, do I get this shot? Then, of course, you have to consider the consequences of that.
Right.
Whereas, it's not as, like, should I get COVID-19 now and by taking this pill?
Right. No. Yeah, yeah.
It's different.
No. And we've talked about this before on the program. Last thing I'll say here today is that, anytime, that's at least what the data on vaccine hesitancy or willingness here in Germany has always shown. Anytime somebody has to go out and make a medical decision, they become much more conservative as opposed to something happening to them. Yeah, it's just...
Risk averse, yeah.
Well, and it's your fault if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
You know, if I catch COVID-19 at a, I don't know, some business meeting or somebody catches it at school, nobody's really to blame. But if I go and I make that choice for myself, then it's my fault at the end of the day. But again...
You said you had one more thing for me today. What
peanuts. Was
that? Peanuts. Make this one quick.
This is quick. This is a quick little peanut.
Blathering away.
No, I'm biased on this one because I have a cousin who has a severe peanut allergy.
Yeah.
And that makes my cousin one of roughly every 50 children in the U.S., roughly 2%, mm-hmm. have an allergic reaction, severe allergic reaction to peanuts. And of course, this can go anaphylactic and end up being fatal.
Yeah.
So there's a clinical trial funded by the National Institute of Health, this is good news, found that giving peanut oral immunotherapy to highly peanut allergic children ages 1 to 3 years old, so that's the age group, safely desensitized most of them basically to their peanut allergies. And
there's a vaccine for peanut allergies?
No, what they were doing, it's way, way more basic than that. The immunotherapy, and this is even more good news, consisted of a daily oral dose of peanut flour for 2.5 years. A little
peanut flour? What's the difference between peanut flour and peanuts?
Peanut flour is probably ground peanuts. In fact, I don't know. Have you ever seen peanut butter made? You grind it up and then eventually
smash
the oil.
It yeah. Together. Yeah. Wait. Why isn't peanut flour bad for people with peanut allergies?
It is. But it's all about the dosage.
Microdosaging?
Yeah, they microdose it and then they gradually increase.
Okay,
the qualification, we're talking about 150 kids studied in 5 different places in the U.S. The qualification was that they had to be so allergic to peanuts that 1.5 peanuts would send them into shock, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly but surely, they upped the dosage of this peanut flour over the course of 2.5 years and it had a wonderful effect.
Exposure therapy, right? Isn't that how to get over a fear of snakes?
Yeah, and what they're not talking
expose
about...
Expose people to snakes more often?
Sort of the same idea. They're not talking about this ever going totally away,
yeah.
But the way that they defined remission was being able to eat 5 grams of peanut protein, which is the equivalent to 1.5 big spoonfuls of peanut butter, tablespoons, without having an allergic reaction 6 months after completing immunotherapy.
That's amazing news.
Isn't
that is
it?
Amazing news for people with this affliction. It's
yeah. And as a lot
terrible.
Of, I saw some comments online that really resonated with me as someone who loves peanut butter cups. That's probably my favorite candy, bar none. I just love that creamy center.
They're pretty thick.
They are so good. And how wonderful that roughly 2% of kids who might not have, you know, been able to enjoy that pleasure. Actually, it's not about that. It's about going to a restaurant, not realizing that there's something, you know, peanut based in there, and accidentally ending up in the hospital and surviving if you're lucky.
No, this of course sounds very debilitating. Yeah.
Yeah, this is great news for a lot of people around the world. So that's where we're going to end it, on that good news.
Anything to say out there about COVID-19 or peanuts or legumes or anything really? Get in touch, su@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.